Means and methods. Just as political leaders employ for their annihilationist and eliminationist projects existing and new institutions in varying combinations, they kill in different ways. It is worth sketching out these methods, even if they are of little analytical importance. Notwithstanding that many writers about the Holocaust fetishize killing logistics and technology, organizing mass killing and technically ending a life, even many lives, is easy. Survivors of the Tutsis' mass murder of Hutu in Burundi in 1972 explain, "There were many manners of killing them," said one. Another agreed, "Several techniques, several, several." Or one can gather 2,000 persons in a house, in a prison, let us say. There are some halls which are large. The house is locked. The men are left there for 15 days without eating, without drinking. Then one opens. One finds cadavers. Not beaten, not anything. Dead. Political leaders possessing the most limited capacities in organizationally and technologically simple societies, including Burundi, Cambodia, and Rwanda, have easily managed to slaughter hundreds of thousands or millions. Killing speed, methods, and implements have more to do with the perpetrator's character, their conception of the victims, the available technological means, and perceived time pressure than with fundamental logistical and technical problems in killing. All technologically and organizationally more sophisticated killing regimes could employ simpler means than they do, with the same results and often more efficiently. Burundi and Rwanda have been among the least developed countries in the world. When the Tutsi slaughtered Hutu in Burundi, it was among the poorest countries, with a per capita yearly income hovering around $200 and an adult illiteracy rate exceeding 70%. When the Hutu slaughtered the Tutsi, Rwanda was only marginally better off, still one of the 20 poorest countries in the world, with an adult illiteracy rate around 50%. Burundi and Rwanda each had an extremely undeveloped infrastructure, with a military and police force that were outfitted with archaic weaponry and insufficient guns and munitions. Guns and bullets were so relatively rare and costly that each country's perpetrators, like Turkey's and others, used them sparingly, choosing the more primitive killing implements of clubs, knives, and machetes. They typically apprehended the victims simply by removing them from their homes or wherever they were, and butchered or bludgeoned them on the spot or nearby. There was nothing sophisticated about these killing operations. No gas chambers, no assembly line killing, no advanced technology, no intricate logistical planning, no complex bureaucratic machinery moving mindlessly forward in supposed stages of destruction. No need for massive transportation. To execute their murderous intentions, political leaders needed only people to carry it out, basic institutional organization, simple communication, and machetes and clubs, sometimes, and only sometimes, backed up by a few 20th century weapons. With such simple means, Rwanda's Hutu conducted as intensive a killing campaign as any of our time. Their average monthly death toll exceeded the Germans' monthly body count of Jews. In 1975, the Khmer Rouge took power in war-ravaged, poor Cambodia. The leadership, headed by Pol Pot, was animated by a strange ideological brew of apocalyptic Marxism and a romanticized vision of ancient Cambodian civilization. They hated modern civilization, particularly modern technology, so they destroyed the country's physical plant, mainly by neglecting it into ruin. Cities are the principal sites of modernity, of economic productivity, of technological capacity. The Khmer Rouge emptied Cambodia's cities almost entirely, forcing the people into a network of rural camps called cooperatives to live and work pre-industrially, with the most primitive means, using only their hands or cups to dig irrigation ditches or Borgesian roads that stretched onward to nowhere for no good purpose. The perpetrators, frequently just teenage boys with little training, were only somewhat better equipped, often having but poor weapons and insufficient munitions. But that didn't stop them from killing. Chahun Bon, a survivor, explains that when the Khmer Rouge executed the people, they didn't shoot a bullet because they wanted to save the bullet. They just hit the people with a stick or like an ant. Some people were not dead yet, but they buried them anyway. And sometimes they just cut them to take their bladder. Or for their medicine. The poorly equipped Khmer Rouge also managed to construct a camp system that contained the vast majority of the country's people, who they controlled with an unsurpassed totalitarian grip. It was mainly in the camps, using primitive means, that the Khmer Rouge killed perhaps 2 million people. Most perished from planned, or what might as well have been planned, starvation, though the perpetrators shot and beat many to death. Ton Jang, a Cambodian survivor, explains, "In 1977 and 1978, we got nothing but gruel to eat. Production was low because of flooding. The dam broke. The locals told us that you had to plant floating rice in this area. But the Khmer Rouge wanted to try something else, and it all died. So there was nothing to eat. The locals' land and houses were all flooded out. In the old society, a family could get by on 1 hectare of land, but now under the Khmer Rouge, there was nothing to eat. This was because farming was collective, or if there was enough food, it was stored away, not given to us to eat. There were 11 people in my family. None were killed, but 10 died of starvation in 1977-78, and only I survived. By 1979, just over 20 families out of 500 were left in the village." Over less than 4 years, this technologically backward and regressing society's political leaders induced their followers to turn society into a large concentration camp, in which they steadily killed or let die through calculated malnutrition those not conforming to the leaders' immediate wishes or image of the future. They turned Cambodia into our time's arguably most murderous, brutal, inhuman small country, utterly dragooning and terrorizing and killing the greatest percentage of a country's entire population, the sparsely populated German colony of Southwest Africa aside. All without modern technology, gas chambers, or assembly line killing. The Germans' extermination of the Jews is infamous precisely for the gas chambers and the so-called assembly line killing. Yet whatever such death factories' existential horror and significance, these installations were not essential for the mass murder. This is so obvious, it is astonishing that the gas chambers have been turned into the horror's central aspect, to the long-time neglect and exclusion of so much else, particularly the perpetrators and the victims, as if the gas chambers and technology themselves caused the killing instead of being the incidental implements of people who wanted to kill. Modern technology was unnecessary, and the Germans knew this. They killed their victims overwhelmingly without gassing. This included their annihilation of 3 million Soviet prisoners of war they mainly starved to death. They just as easily could have starved their Auschwitz gassing victims. While the Germans were gassing Jews, they continued to shoot Jews by the tens of thousands, just as they had before they built the gas chambers. Early in their attack on the Soviet Union during summer and early fall 1941, the Germans shot hundreds of thousands of Jews, including 23,600 in Kamenets-Podolsky over 2 days, 19,000 in Minsk in 2 massacres combined, 21,000 in Rovno over 2 days, 25,000 near Riga over 3 days, and more than 33,000 in Babi Yar over 2 days. These killing rates far exceeded what the death factories using gas chambers ever achieved. Gassing, especially in camps, may offer the perpetrators aesthetic advantages, but it is inefficient. So inefficient that no other mass murderers have seen it economically rational or technically necessary to construct them. Shooting people on the spot is much easier and requires fewer resources than rounding them up, getting them to a train line, guarding them the whole way, diverting scarce train engines and freight cars from critical military and economic functions, loading the victims, transporting and guarding them hundreds of miles, and only then killing and disposing of them using technology that sometimes breaks down. The Germans adopted gassing for killing Jews, not for efficiency, but because they had a rare inventive killing spirit, were consciously planning to continue killing well into the future, wished to distance the killers from the gruesome task, and symbolically liked to think they were disinfecting the world, especially of Jews. Only a tiny percentage of our era's mass murder victims were felled by methods of killing invented during our time. Roughly 4 million out of the 125 million or more victims, at most less than 4%. The Germans gassed most of the total killed with modern technology. Japanese exterminated 580,000 Chinese and Koreans with biological warfare weapons and experimentation. American atomic bombs incinerated or killed with radiation more than 250,000 Japanese. The Americans and British carpet-bombed German and Japanese cities, slaughtering several hundred thousand more. Assad used artillery and tanks to shell Hama, Saddam gassed several tens of thousands of Kurds, and Al-Qaeda used hijacked airplanes to murder nearly 3,000 Americans. Our age's mass murderers killed more than 95% of their victims using technologically unsophisticated means. Starvation and attendant diseases have taken the lives of most, followed in some order by gunshots and various types of blades or clubs that have been available since antiquity. The Soviets killed the overwhelming majority of their victims by starvation, the cold, and predictably devastating diseases. In Turkey, China, Kenya, Indonesia, Nigeria, Sudan, Congo, and virtually all our age's mass murders, the perpetrators murdered the vast majority of their victims either by calculated starvation or bullets or some combination of the two. Once a regime chooses its eliminationist institutions, the logistics of mass annihilation and elimination are not difficult. When the intended victims are coterminous with a city, town, or building, the municipality or structure itself can be targeted, as the Americans did with Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Tokyo, the British did with Dresden, Assad did with Hama, and Bin Laden did with the World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon, in what strangely is conceived of as only a terrorist attack, and not also the genocidal or eliminationist assault that it was. In more conventional mass murders and eliminations, the killers easily round up the victims. Sometimes the perpetrators and victims are segmented geographically, as in Biafra and in assault by the political Islamists governing in northern Sudan, first on black African people in southern Sudan, and now those of the large western region of Darfur, the size of France. Sometimes physical markers such as skin color differentiate the perpetrators and the victims. Generally, the killers or their local helpers know their targets and where to locate them. This was true of the Germans in Southwest Africa, the Turks, the Germans, the Croats during World War II, the British in Kenya, the Indonesians slaughtering the communists, the Serbs in Bosnia and then Kosovo, the Tutsi in Burundi, the Hutu in Rwanda, Saddam's henchmen in Iraq, and in so many other instances. In Germany itself, the Germans used genealogical records to determine who they would treat as a Jew in the small percentage of cases where the quantity of a person's Jewish blood was in doubt. Exceptions aside, the amount needed to be at least 50%. Outside of their own country, the Germans were far less particular, ready to slaughter just about anyone local people identified as Jews. In Poland, Lithuania, Ukraine, and elsewhere, many were happy to oblige. When Lithuanians, Ukrainians, or Poles, such as in Poland's 1941 Jedwabne massacre, slaughtered the Jews with German encouragement or assistance, they were murdering their own neighbors whom they knew well, a phenomenon seen recently by a virtually uncomprehending world in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, particularly Bosnia. In annihilationist assaults, the perpetrators either congregate their victims at collection points, sometimes using the ruse that they are relocating them. The Germans used this standard technique to deport Jews to the death camps or to take them outside a city to be shot. The Turks earlier and the Khmer Rouge later did the same for their massive, lethal death marches. Or, as the Germans also often did, and the perpetrators did in Indonesia, Burundi, and Rwanda, or in several Latin American countries, as in Guatemala or El Salvador, they suddenly and with overwhelming force descend upon their victims. With rare exceptions, the perpetrators manage to kill an extraordinarily high percentage of the victims they actually try to apprehend. They succeed similarly with expulsions and eliminationist incarceration campaigns. Few other political programs are so successful and produce such high yields. All this is organized with varying combinations of centralized control and local initiative. Political leaders, after opting for annihilation programs, almost always orchestrate them from the political center, with standard communication channels transmitting orders to killing institutions and field commanders. As with other aspects of mass murder, how regimes manage and monitor those implementing their eliminationist and exterminationist programs varies. Different killing sites and institutions provide a range of opportunities for perpetrators to take lethal initiative. Regimes can more easily oversee camp guards than perpetrators shepherding death marches or in mobile killing squads, especially when killing in small groups. Most eliminationist assaults have poor command and control structures because they take place in technologically underdeveloped countries, such as Turkey in 1915, Cambodia, or Rwanda, with poorly monitored new institutions and under improvised conditions over vast terrains. Whatever the formal command pathways, the reality, which leaders understand, is that at the point of attack, perpetrators can themselves decide a great deal about how and whom to kill. Dejan Pavlovich, an independent Serbian journalist, explains how it worked in Bosnia. State security sent men to each Bosnian municipality looking for trusted persons who would act as allies. These trusted persons would be told that the area needed to be secured for reasons of convoy security or military strategy, and that, as a result, the Muslims needed to be cleared out. Sometimes the local police chief, sometimes the mayor, sometimes the hospital director would be in charge. "You'll never find one method or one chain of command for ethnic cleansing," Pavlovich comments about the former Yugoslavia, "because in each area the person or groups responsible for carrying out the ethnic cleansing was different. Each commander used a different method based on the tools he had." The Germans' command and control systems were probably as formal and good as any, yet every German in the East could, at a whim, choose to murder Jews and other so-called subhumans without fearing punishment. In eliminationist assaults, the perpetrators quickly learn that overzealousness in wiping out the targeted enemy is not penalized. The perpetrators know they may do as they wish. The number of instances in which perpetrators have been reprimanded or punished for overdoing it is, as far as we know, exceedingly small. Just as eliminationist and annihilationist institutions vary temporally and spatially, so do eliminationist programs as a whole. Temporally, mass murders and eliminations can be 1. Focused, a single, time-bounded assault, 2. Iterative, a series of focused assaults, or 3. Systemic, continual and drawn out. Focused mass murders and eliminations are common. Where the targeted group or group's death is pursued as an end in itself, or for some immediate strategic gain and not as part of some larger transformative project, focused killings result. The Americans' nuclear bombings of the Japanese in Hiroshima and Nagasaki constitute the most fearsome, instantaneous of all mass murders. Each attack lasted a few seconds, although many died later and others continued to suffer from radiation poisoning. If the American attacks on Hiroshima's and Nagasaki's people are seen as the culmination of the annihilative bombing campaign against the Japanese in Tokyo, Kyoto, and elsewhere, then Americans' slaughtering of Japanese from the air lasted somewhat longer. Focused mass killings and eliminations, other than nuclear annihilations, can begin and end quickly, as did Al-Qaeda's destruction of the World Trade Center and Assad's mass murder of Hama's people. They can also last months or even several years, as did the Germans' extermination of the Herero and then of the Nama, Indonesians' slaughter of communists, the Serbs' various eliminationist onslaughts of the 1990s, and Saddam's eliminationist assault against the Marsh people. Iterative mass murders and eliminations consist of political leaders initiating the slaughter of a group's members, halting it, and then relaunching the slaughter sometimes years later. The Turks mass murdered Armenians on three occasions. Although these slaughters spanned almost two decades, they were of one cloth. Since decolonization, Burundi has seen four substantial murderous forays by Tutsi against Hutu, killing thousands in 1965, more than 100,000 in 1972, perhaps 20,000 in 1988, and 3,000 in 1991. In 1993, reciprocal killings, first of Tutsi by Hutu, and then by the Tutsi army of Hutu, took an estimated 25,000 lives on each side. Neighboring Rwanda saw the first mass slaughter between these two groups when the Hutu killed perhaps 10,000 Tutsi in December 1963 and January 1964, which inflamed and heightened the insecurity of the Tutsi in neighboring Burundi. And then the colossal bloodbath of 800,000 Tutsi in 1994. The Croats' successive slaughter of Serbs during World War II, and then again their murder and expulsion campaign during Yugoslavia's breakup, could also be seen as iterative slaughters, as could the Serbs' reciprocal slaughter of Croats in 1991 through 1992. Iterative mass murdering and elimination may be part of a general eliminationist, even annihilationist strategy, or it may be lethal domination's most brutal form, used to thin out and weaken the targeted people and to intimidate them with the real threat of renewed annihilative assaults. Systemic mass annihilation and elimination consist of ongoing acts that are not iterative and episodic, but an integral part of a regime's rule. For this to happen, regimes establish enduring eliminationist institutions, typically a camp system. This occurred in the brutal Belgian and French colonial regimes in Congo and French Equatorial Africa, respectively, Germany during the Nazi period, the Soviet Union, mid-century Japan, Communist China, the British colonization of Kenya, Cambodia, Ba'athist Iraq, and North Korea. Other regimes, also sometimes using camps, undertake frequent eliminationist and exterminationist assaults or campaigns, often repeatedly using the same cadres of killers who may be special army units. Such regimes existed in Uganda, Chile, Argentina, Guatemala, Vietnam, and Iraq. Systemic mass murder and elimination occur when political leaders decide to achieve their goals or deal with opposition or unwanted people with lethal violence or policies that, whatever the reasons for their design, the leaders know will end in mass death. Even though political leaders' attacks against some discrete groups are sometimes focused, as were the Khmer Rouge's killing of the Cham and the Germans' murderous assault against the Polish elite in 1940, mass murder and elimination become these leaders' normal political practice as they impose their rule on highly resistant populations, or ones not conforming to the leaders' transformative visions. It is those leaders seeking to alter their societies in some revolutionary ideology's image who construct vast camp systems as both sustainable and flexible tools for sequestering and dominating, or, over time, killing vast numbers of people. Some perpetrators' eliminationist campaigns, both focused and iterative, are related to the assaults others perpetrate upon them and other people. Poles, Czechs, and others' expulsions and killings of ethnic Germans after World War II immediately followed the Germans' annihilationist onslaughts in Central and Eastern Europe, though their occupation of Czech lands had been, by the Germans' standards, relatively tame. Croats and Serbs have iteratively slaughtered one another during World War II and then 50 years later during Yugoslavia's breakup. The Hutu and Tutsi in Burundi and Rwanda have iteratively slaughtered one another and caused hundreds of thousands to flee in seven major exterminationist episodes since the countries gained independence from Belgium in 1962. In these places, a clear dynamic of reciprocity has set in, where mass elimination has become each group's principal tool for neutralizing real and perceived enemies. Mass murder and elimination's spatial and temporal aspects tend to be intertwined. Focused mass murderers mainly kill their victims around where they find them, whether in the victim's homes, outdoors, or at some nearby designated killing site. When the perpetrators of focused mass slaughters and expulsions remove people from their locales, they often use death marches. Iterative mass murders mimic focused ones spatially. Systemic mass murders and eliminations have longer time horizons and institutional structures that include enduring, fixed installations, so their perpetrators regularly remove the victims from their home environs, especially to camps, even if they also may conduct, as the Germans in particular did, local killing operations. The sympathies of others and the problem of resistance. Many people, aside from the perpetrators and victims, know of the ongoing assaults and, unlike the generally helpless victims, have some capacity to influence them. These bystanders may be physically present watching the killings, living in the perpetrators' countries or areas of occupation, or powerful actors, such as presidents and prime ministers, in countries outside the eliminationist zones. In overt or subtle ways, they either help or hinder the perpetrators. The failure of families, friends, and countrymen to disapprove of or to hinder eliminationist acts can help the perpetrators, especially when it strengthens their resolve to kill. The moral status of such acts of omission, important to investigate, is a long discussion that I have taken up in A Moral Reckoning. Similar to perpetrators, bystanders are positioned differently vis-à-vis mass killing and elimination. Some work in state or military institutions, even in eliminationist institutions, without being involved in the eliminationist program. Others, the ones most frequently referred to as bystanders, stand by while the perpetrators drag entire families, often neighbors, from their houses, watch as they shoot or stab their victims, or as death marches limp through their towns, or dwell near the camps where victims live in misery and die. Most frequently, these bystanders, sharing the critical identity, national, ethnic, religious, etc., with the perpetrators, know that the perpetrators believe themselves to be acting in the bystanders' name and for their good. Such bystanders have existed in virtually every mass murder and elimination. Turks, Greeks, Indians and Pakistanis, British settlers in Kenya, Hutu, Serbs, and many other peoples have literally and figuratively watched their countrymen butcher or otherwise eliminate their neighbors. Some bystanders, such as the peoples of occupied countries or of non-perpetrator groups, do not share the perpetrator's critical identity. They are under the occupier's boot, subject to violence, and as a group, might be potential victims. Such bystanders include Poles and others under German occupation, repressed minorities in the Soviet Union, and people in any occupied country or disputed territory where a large but not comprehensive mass murder is being perpetrated. Finally, bystanders exist outside the mass murder or elimination's geographic realm. The most important are state leaders and officials, and sometimes those of transnational organizations such as the Catholic Church, the Red Cross, or corporations. How they can influence a mass annihilation or elimination is taken up in later chapters. Domestic bystanders can have a direct or indirect influence on mass murder. In many countries, bystanders help perpetrators by identifying victims or locating where they are hiding. In doing so, they transform themselves into perpetrators. Many other bystanders succor the perpetrators with expressions of approval or encouragement, or solidaristic hatred, or with tangible aid of food, shelter, and goods. Just by not conveying disapproval in overt or subtle ways, bystanders reassure perpetrators that they do not stand alone. When bystanders disapprove of an eliminationist assault, they can save people's lives. It is nonsense to maintain that it is impossible to aid people targeted for extermination, a notion that so many writers about Nazism and the Holocaust have put forward that exculpates Germans, the peoples of occupied countries, and religious institutions, especially the Catholic Church. Looking to guerrilla insurgencies, we know that if a country's people do not support its government, the insurgents will receive food, shelter, aid, and intelligence. This was true for Polish partisans in Poland, Soviet partisans in the Soviet Union, the French underground in France, to name just a few, during World War II. Similar aid could be given, and sometimes is, to the people targeted in eliminationist assaults. When it is not, it tells us a great deal about a populace's attitude toward the mass killing and elimination. When people give aid, many lives can be preserved. The Danish people saved virtually all the Jews among them, including many non-Danes, by ferrying them to non-combatant Sweden. Although the Bulgarian government handed over Jews from territories it occupied in Greece and Yugoslavia to the Germans who slaughtered them, under much pressure from the Bulgarian public, parliamentarians, and most significant, the Bulgarian Orthodox Church's leadership, it refused to allow the Germans to deport and murder Bulgaria's own Jews. If a large percentage of Germans or Hutu or Serbs had believed the annihilation of Jews, Tutsi or Muslims respectively, to be one of our age's great horrors, then their countrymen certainly would have killed many fewer Jews, Tutsi or Muslims, perhaps not even a substantial number at all. More locally, the French of Le Chambon-sur-Lignon saved between 3,000 and 5,000 Jews, even though Germans were all around their region and often in their town. Across Europe, including in many Catholic institutions, individual dissenters saved Jews, totaling in the thousands. In Rwanda, individual Hutu who dissented from the common anti-Tutsi creed managed to save many Tutsi, and Hutu Muslims frequently showed solidarity for and aided their Tutsi co-religionists. Even if the circumstances, institutional infrastructure, and resources inhibit large-scale rescues, disapproving bystanders can still save many lives one by one, or a handful here and a handful there. Mao's famous dictum provides an essential question. Who are the fish in the sea of bystanders, the perpetrators or the victims? When it is the perpetrators which has been the rule, then the victims have nowhere to run or hide. Bystander hostility to victims is ultimately a significant factor contributing directly and contextually to an enormous number of deaths. The bystander problem, as it is typically discussed, is why do people stand by idly in the face of horrors? But as we see, this renders the issue falsely by concealing more than a figurative half of the problem, which is the various kinds of support that bystanders freely give to the perpetrators. Bystanders' support for mass exterminations and eliminations is critical for another important reason. The perpetrators are rarely confronted with widespread, let alone successful, resistance, because without bystander support, the victims have no reasonable prospect of preventing the executioners from killing or eliminating them. This would hardly be worth mentioning, except that the blame the victim cliché has been intoned incessantly when discussing the Jews' conduct, like sheep to slaughter, during the Holocaust. For people to resist eliminationist assaults, they must have some possibility of success. Under hopeless conditions, usually only small-scale, symbolic resistance is possible. Rational calculation and people's psychological propensities suppress the urge to fight. The targeted groups understand that resistance guarantees death, and as long as people hold out hope of survival, they are unlikely to fight. This is especially so as men, who generally lead resistance, have endangered families requiring their continuing presence. Not surprisingly, Jews in some ghettos and camps revolted when the annihilation's comprehensiveness had proceeded to a point of absolute hopelessness. These revolts produced, perhaps, symbolic victory, but ended in catastrophic defeat.